Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show on which we mourn the death of our childhoods in talking about the new 2016 Paul Feig-directed remake reboot of Ghostbusters with Eric Asperschlager.
I'm a salty parabola.
Yes, you are. That's a deep cut for those of you 2016 Ghostbusters fans.
It's like 5 minutes into the movie.
mean deep in terms of where it falls in the movie. I mean, it's not like the line that everyone's going to be quoting, I guess, unless they're eating Pringles.
They might.
I
probably will from here on out.
Soon to tell. The movie has just come out. And we're going to be talking about it in just a little bit, spoiler-free, and then we will move into spoilers for those of you who don't want to hear the secrets of the film revealed before getting a chance to see it. We'll be talking about all that later. We'll talk about what we've seen lately, but of course, first, I have to say thank you to everyone once again for participating in, / listening to, / donating to our F Breast Cancer Live 18-hour podcast-a-thon, which took place over a week ago by the time this show comes out. I think it was a success. People seemed to like it. We got through the whole thing, which was, to me, a success to just have finished the 18 hours. We had some excellent guests and raised... At this point, there's actually donations still kind of trickling in. So actually, at this point, we're up to almost $7,500 for the Magnolia Tree Foundation.
Wow.
Which, yeah, is just incredible and exceeded whatever expectations I had. I wasn't even sure what to expect, but people just kind of blew me away with their generosity. And at the end of the 18-hour broadcast, of course, people were in the little chat section on YouTube Live saying, hey, can we do this every year? Which is easy for all of you to say because you didn't have to be on the air for 18 hours. But here's the thing. It's, you know, it's something I would certainly think about. The issue is I think it's hard to keep going back to people every year and asking them to donate so generously. And I would really only want to do it if I knew we could continue to raise a lot of money for the Magnolia Tree Foundation. So,
well, I'll say this about people, Patrick. They continue to make money.
Good point.
If you have a job, I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe perhaps you've never had a job, but you continue to get paid generally on a bi-weekly. I always get those two confused. Anyway, people make money. I think we could do it again. And by we, I mean you, because I was on for an hour.
So you were, but what an hour you were on! And I'm going to try to keep my kids from barging in on this podcast.
You're kidding. They saved the hour.
Taking over the whole thing. Eventually, Eric and myself talking about Star Trek movies will be released as its own podcast for those of you who were unable to listen the day of or who tuned out when they're like, I'm not into Star Trek, or who just don't like my kids. That will be made available sometime in the coming weeks. I know people have been saying that they appreciate the fact that we've been posting those. So thank you. And we will continue to make those available over the coming weeks.
That's good news. I thought in the immediate aftermath of the podcast-a-thon, it sounded like after a certain point in the day, you may not have had audio.
I didn't. The YouTube live stream, which is what we used to broadcast, which I was generally happy with until around hour 14, I think, when it started to buffer really badly during the Daily Dead roundtable, to the point where people were like 10 minutes behind or so.
Yeah, when we finished our hour, I went and I started listening, you know, live, because I'm not just a caller, I'm also a listener. And I heard the last like 10 minutes of our show live. It was a little surreal.
Absolutely weird. So so I was happy with YouTube Live, but I know around the it only archived about the first 12 hours. So sometime during the Adam Green interview, my archive cut out. And I had written a piece on the site just thanking everyone. And I had mentioned in the site, or in the article, hey, you know, my archive cut out after about 12 hours. If for any reason someone was like randomly recording this and you have any of the remaining hours, please let me know. And I was contacted at our email address, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, by a listener named Tim Levine. I hope I'm saying that right. It might be Tim Levine, who did have a large chunk of that missing piece recorded and graciously passed it along to me. So thank you so much, Tim, not only for recording it, but for reaching out and sending that to me. So your hour and the Rod Himes and the Daily Dead Roundtable, all that stuff has been preserved.
Great.
I don't think all of the last hour is there, but that's okay because it's just I was a little bit delirious at that point and nobody wants to relive that.
I was sleeping.
So thank you again, Tim. Before we talk about Ghostbusters, Eric, have you seen anything good lately?
I have. It's been a while since I've been on the show. Yeah, I know. That's funny. But I have seen some good stuff, some stuff to talk about. I finally, this is a favorite on the FThis Movie website, but I finally just recently saw Green Room.
Okay, yes. And reviewed it for DVD Verdict, and it was a great review.
Did. Thank you very much. Yeah, I loved it. I really, really loved it. And I'm glad that I saw it. This is maybe kind of a weird thing because you don't have to see it this way, but I'm glad that I saw it after watching Welcome to Leith, which is another Patrick Brownlee recommendation, because I feel like seeing the real-life equivalent of some of what you see in the movie kind of made it more, not interesting, but impactful. Okay. Kind of getting a sense. I mean, Welcome to Leith can show you how a relatively normal looking older guy can actually be, you know, the cunning leader of a psychopath army. Maybe not quite as cunning as Patrick Stewart, but who is? I think that would make an interesting double feature.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I'm just going to throw that out there. But yeah, no, Green Room was great. Obviously, a lot has been said about how tense it is and how visceral and thrilling and, you know, scary and all that kind of stuff. And it is all of those things. It was interesting to watch it and look at it almost less as a horror film and more as like a war film. Because it definitely has that compared to something like Assault on Precinct 13, where the attackers are this kind of they're almost like the gang equivalent of someone like a Michael Myers or like a slasher,
right?
Where it's just sort of like a silent, deadly, relentless protagonist, and the bad guys in Green Room are no less relentless, but they're also kind of more organized, more intelligent, and more cunning, and kind of really force the protagonists to have to up their game in some interesting ways. So that is a good movie and a good Blu-ray. I think Jeremy Saulnier gives a really interesting commentary and there's some other good stuff. So
nice. I want to check that out. One of my favorite things about the movie, one of the scariest things I think, isn't just kind of the visceral moments of action or like the attacks. It's the way that the whatever you want to call them, skinheads, hate group, whatever, occasionally we'll just stop everything and like think three steps ahead and how smart they are and how they're controlling the situation, I think, mm-hmm. is so scary because you realize what's happening and you're just filled with so much dread because you know that the character's on screen while also intelligent and not making stupid choices. You know, that's one of the great things about the movie is that neither side is stupid or easily taken advantage of. But you know that eventually they're kind of going to give in because what choice do they have? And the scene where Macon Blair first, when the inciting incident first happens and Macon Blair just kind of stops and is like, wait, let's stop here and think about this. I just thought was like one of the best scenes in the movie.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I mean, it would be scary, intense. You would feel that the, your heroes or whatever were just as screwed. If it just happened to be a giant army of skinheads outside, the fact that they are well organized and smart makes it even more terrifying.
Yeah, for sure.
So check that out. During Junesploitation, I signed up for a free month of Shudder.
Nice.
Because I thought that would be helpful. And it was marginally helpful. I watched a few movies on there. One of them that I watched, and I don't know, I don't think it lined up with the specific day because I'm terrible when it comes to Junesploitation. I did watch several movies It definitely got me in the exploitation genre mindset. So thank you for that. I did not do a great job of keeping up day by day, but I'm not going to apologize for that here because I'm going to do enough apologizing, I'm sure, over the course of the episode. but I did watch some stuff. I watched a movie, I think because I'd never heard of it before, and I want to see what it was about, called Applesauce.
Yeah, that's the Honor Turkel movie.
Okay, there. I can't remember the name of the director. But it's kind of an odd thing for what seems to be Shudder's bread and butter, which is, you know, horror, sometimes really disturbing cover art and description horror. But it's an indie. I call it more of a drama than anything else. But it's takes place in New York City. There's a guy who did something bad when he was in college, and now someone is sending him body parts in the mail. And that's the basic, you know, description. Sounds horrific. I mean, really, more than anything, it's kind of a movie that is about how, you know, decisions and things that people do have rippling consequences, and the way people's lives intermingle and bump up against each other. It's pretty interesting. I mean, for, you know, if you want to see something you haven't seen before, like, I mean, literally something you haven't seen before, I don't know that it does something other movies don't do, but, you know, it's always nice when I find something that wasn't just recommended to me by you or Adam. Because I feel like, I mean, after Green Room and My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, I just feel like I'm following in Adam's footsteps. But it's good, you know. I mean, if I see something, I want to review it. I want to know it's coming from, coming well recommended. But you notice I'm not talking about My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 here. Not because it's a bad movie, but anyway. So Applesauce, I think, is interesting from an indie drama perspective. But the thing that struck me the most when I was watching it, which has nothing to do with the movie, is that the main guy in the movie reminds me so much of Devin Faraci.
Yeah,
and I've never met Devin Faraci. I've only seen pictures of him. I've listened to him on podcasts. He sounds exactly like him. He looks similar. And so it's like spending an hour and a half with Devin Faraci if he was being sent body parts in the mail. And that, I think, you know, I think your mileage may vary on whether that sounds interesting to you, but I was fascinated.
He is I mispronounced his name. It's Honor Tukel, or there's no, it's not Turkel, there's no R. Honor Tukel. And he so that actor, the lead, is also the writer director.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I've not yet seen Applesauce. I saw that it was on Shudder and I'd wanted to watch it. I spoke about it a little bit with Kate Cannon. But I did see his last movie, which is called Summer of Blood, which he also wrote and directed, and it's about a guy who's just like the laziest son of a bitch ever. Who is then he gets bit by a vampire and becomes kind of like a slacker vampire. And again, it's one of these, it's like, it sounds kind of like how you're describing Applesauce, which is like, I like the idea. The execution is like 75% of the way there. Like,
yeah,
it's not wasted time, but it's not, it never quite fully forms into the movie that maybe you want it to be or that it has the potential to be. Summer of Blood, I think, is worth a look. It's also on Shudder. And I still plan to check out Applesauce as well.
That's cool. That's cool. Speaking of Devin Faraci, which is not a phrase people say very often.
retweeted our.
Yeah.
Because you had, I saw that you reached out to him, and I thought that was awfully kind.
I wanted to get the word out. I have no idea if it made any impact. It got a few likes, but eh, you know.
We're talking around it. So Eric reached out to Devin in the lead up to our fundraiser and said, hey, you know, we're organizing this fundraiser to raise money for breast cancer and we could use the Faraci bump. And Devin Faraci retweeted us. And so that was very kind. Drew McQueenie from HitFix also retweeted us and got the word out. Steve Procopi from Ain't It Cool News, he writes under the name Capone, during the day was messaging me basically saying, hey, if you need me to jump in, because I think I had said like, oh, I'm by myself the rest of the night. And by that, I meant in my basement. I didn't necessarily mean on the air, but I think he interpreted it as like, you're going to try to do that.
Right.
So he was messaging me saying like, well, if you need someone, you know, let me know. So thank you to some of these major film bloggers for helping out.
100%. But for the most, I've been listening to his podcast with Amy Nicholson, The Canon.
Yes.
And last week they did a head-to-head with two Paul Thomas Anderson movies, Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood. And so I rewatched both of those before listening to the podcast because it had been a little while since I've seen both. I've seen Boogie Nights a billion times. I think I'd only seen There Will Be Blood once, but I wanted to, you know, they're great movies. I own them. I wanted to watch them. So I watched them. That was a lot of fun. And that got me into kind of like, oh, what else is out? What other Paul Thomas Anderson movies should I watch? There are some I haven't seen. And I realized I'd never actually gotten around to watching The Master, which had been on Netflix for a while. But it's one of those things where it's, you know, it's over 2.5 hours long. I want to make sure I have time to really, you know, watch it. I never really did. I still didn't. So I decided, well, I'm going to watch it anyway. I'm going to sit down. I'll watch a bunch of it now. This is Thursday. I'll watch some of it now, and then I'll finish it like tomorrow. I'll finish it on Friday. And I definitely enjoyed what I saw. And by when I say what I saw, I mean that I watched half of it Thursday as planned, got tired, went to bed, woke up on Friday and found that it had been taken off of Netflix.
Oh my gosh.
This is the first time it's ever happened to me.
That's awful.
I can't believe it's never happened to me before because that is the ticking time bomb of our all digital future. And it's my own damn fault because it's been on Netflix for like 2 years. But I definitely will seek out the rest of the Masters so I can eventually find out what happens. But that was actually, I mostly just want to talk about how it went off of Netflix.
That's incredibly.
Has that ever happened to you?
It absolutely has. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
A couple times.
But like in the middle of watching it,
You probably watch
things all in one sitting.
I generally try to, just because I feel like it's unfair to the movie to break it up, which sometimes, you know, you don't have a choice. But yeah, I've definitely been in situations where I'm halfway through a movie and then I fall asleep or something and I wake up in the morning and try to finish it and it's gone.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I definitely would have expected something like that to happen at the end of a month. But I guess they also do stuff like halfway through the month. So this is your PSA. It's your PTA PSA, folks. Make sure you watch all your stuff, all your Netflix movies before the 15th and before the 1st, because you never know. You never know.
That Canon episode was a heartbreaker because I don't like thinking that only one of those movies can get in.
I know. They're both great. I mean, watching it again, I liked There Will Be Blood very much the first time I saw it. I liked it even more the second time. And then watching Boogie Nights, I just find brand new things to appreciate in that movie. I mean, that's a movie where the characters play dumb, but it's great. I mean, like I can't think of the nicest, sweetest dumb people in any movie ever. Just, I mean, the scene where John C. Reilly and Mark Wahlberg are like comparing how much they venture, and that, like, all that stuff is just so sweet and honest and stuff. That's what a great movie. This is not a Boogie Nights podcast, but
it should be. Let's talk about Boogie Nights.
I love that movie.
Anything besides half of The Master?
Yeah, one last thing. This is also a Shudder. No, it's not a joint, but Shudder thing.
Got it.
This is another movie that I heard you talk about because I'm anything if unoriginal. But I finally saw, and this is something I want to see for a while, finally saw Willow Creek.
Oh, okay.
The Bobcat Goldthwait found footage Bigfoot movie. And I'm not a big fan of found footage stuff.
Nor am I.
I am a big fan of Bigfoot, however. I don't know why. It's not a secret shame. But I mean, honestly, if there were people coming out with Bigfoot hoaxes every week, I would fall for it every week. I want it to be true. I don't know why, but for whatever reason, the idea of Bigfoot fascinates me. There was like there was some hoax a few years back where some guys said they found a dead Bigfoot and they put it in their freezer. They ended with like at some point they had a press conference that they aired on cable news. And I watched this stream down the internet because I wanted it to be true. And it turned out to be a gorilla suit filled with animal guts. But in my heart, it was a real.
Those animal guts belonged to a Bigfoot.
That is right. So, yeah. So I watched Willow Creek. And I think they did Bobcat Goldthwait and the actors and everything. They did a really good job of justifying the format, I thought, and using it to its kind of full advantage. A lot of times I have a huge problem in found footage movies, which is how, you know, it's supposed to be real. You know, the setup is supposed to be kind of real footage that someone either found or shot or whatever. And a lot of times just the acting between, you know, the things the actors say to each other just don't feel natural. They don't feel real.
Right.
I assume a lot of it's, you know, improv'd and, you know, it's hard. It's hard enough in a, you know, movie where you have lines written out to sound natural. But I thought the leads did a good job of sounding natural. Like it had, you know, a good amount of the dialogue seemed kind of quote unquote pointless, but it also revealed things about their relationship and kind of kept things moving forward and, you know, sprinkled little details about Bigfoot. I thought it was pretty scary, at the end. The last bit of it is pretty intense. But I will say two things I think would have made the movie better. And I guess this would technically be a spoiler for Willow Creek. So go ahead. If you don't want to be spoiled on Willow Creek, go ahead and skip ahead 45 minutes and we'll come back. No, not really skip ahead 45 minutes. But it's interesting, isn't it? This is another side topic. We're never going to get to Ghostbusters. But on podcasts, when people have spoilers, and I've done this myself, you say, just skip ahead 2 minutes. Like, right. How do you know right. you're actually going to talk for 2 minutes?
Right. You don't.
What if the person comes back and
skips too far and missed something critical?
Too far and missed, or skips, and there you go. You're re-spoiling it in the middle of the thing. So I'm actually going to time myself. So come back in 2 minutes and 37 seconds.
All right.
And I will, and I'm just the spoilers for Willow Creek. I'm going to start my own timer. Okay, right now. There we go. So I started my timer. I'm actually pretty sure this is going to take 2 minutes and 37 seconds. So I'm going to waste time at the beginning.
Okay.
But how you doing?
I'm all right, you know.
Yeah. So anyway, Willow Creek. So two things. One thing, I wish we'd seen Bigfoot.
Yes.
Wish we'd gotten a glimpse of Bigfoot because that was my biggest disappointment.
Definitely.
Tied in with that, this is how I wish the movie had ended. Same thing. They get attacked. You know, all that stuff happens. You see what you see. There's sort of that Blair Witch moment with, you know, the woman and the stuff. The camera falls to the ground. What I wish happened was, okay, the camera is still attached to the guy's hand in some way, right? Bigfoot drags him. You see the camera being dragged back. Bigfoot drags the camera and the guy back to his lair. And then Bigfoot picks up the camera. Maybe that's where we see Bigfoot. And then Bigfoot hits rewind. Mm-hmm. And we find out we've been watching the whole movie through Bigfoot's eyes. And that's the reason. Because there's really no reason for us to have seen what we see.
Right.
Because who's going to – I mean, maybe someone finds that right. somewhere. But no one ever comes out there. Right. All this. So maybe the reason we've seen this – and that's another thing about found footage movies is, you know, they got to come up with a reason why people are finding this. Or they make something up or whatever. Right. In this case, we find out – it was Bigfoot the whole time.
What if Bigfoot just turned the camera around and was like, "What's up, everyone? I'm Bigfoot. This is my unboxing video."
Wait, unboxing of the the lead guy.
Just rips him open. Gonna be opening up this bro. I mean, unfortunately, you know, every found footage movie essentially ends the same way, because it's like everyone has to die so that. The implication is that, you know, somebody finds the footage later on. Let me ask you this. The centerpiece of the film is kind of a, like, almost a 15-minute or 18-minute unbroken take
yes.
inside of a tent.
Yes.
I saw the movie during its very brief theatrical run. Actually, I saw it as part of a festival. So, obviously, that scene really played mm-hmm. in a theater where there's no distractions. It's on a huge screen. The sound design is all over the place. How does that scene play at home?
It plays pretty well, and actually, I didn't watch it at home, and I will tell you why. We have by the way, 17 seconds left till the 2:37, so I'm going to start okay. being a little less
no
spoiler
Bigfoot,
right
no
now because people
no
are going to come back.
No Bigfoot, no Bigfoot,
right? Exactly, no Bigfoot, no whammies, no whammies. Stop. All right, all right, we're close enough. So I was having this weird problem with Shudder with that movie specifically, where I could not get it to load on my computer. It kept like just hanging up on the very first shot of the movie.
The movie Shudder doesn't want you to see.
I finally got it to work, on my iPod, and then I just threw it up on my, Apple TV and, you know, I'm an Apple guy. And, so I was watching it, on my TV that way, but because I couldn't load it in the browser after that, I actually ended up watching that scene on my iPod with the headphones in.
Interesting.
A terrible way to watch a movie, but I don't know. It still worked. Maybe a found footage movie is not as bad to watch on a small screen. Sure. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, sure. like, you know, they're just shooting it essentially on a handheld device of some sort. I don't know if it was a smartphone or a GoPro or a whatever the kids use these days, but it still played. It still worked. I mean, the sound design of the vague right. Centerpiece of the movie, I think still works. So yeah, I liked it kind of more than I thought I would, despite the fact that I am for some reason a Bigfoot nut. So
yeah, as somebody who does, you know, it's for a found footage movie, it's pretty good. I guess that's about what I can say, because I don't care for found footage. I don't care for the aesthetic, but that one's pretty good.
I concur.
Yeah.
So, Patrick, that's all I have. Whatever, 5,000 hours in. What, have you seen anything good lately?
I have seen a bunch of stuff. I will choose just four to talk about fairly briefly. The first is a movie called All Things Must Pass, which is a documentary that came out last year, directed by Colin Hanks, son of Tom. And it is about the history of Tower Records. So it starts in like the 60s with the opening of Tower Records, when it's just like part of a drugstore, all the way through kind of all of them being closed in the United States. Apparently it's still huge in Japan. But in the US, all the Tower Records have closed because of digital music and file sharing and piracy and iTunes and all of this stuff. It's interesting in so far is in that it is pretty thorough in terms of its little niche. I don't know, you know, I would recommend it for music fans or if people have an interest in the history of Tower Records. It can sort of be extrapolated to the larger world of, you know, the music scene and kind of charting the progress of music through the last 40 years, but not quite. It's almost so specific to Tower Records that even when it gets into kind of the downfall of brick and mortar record stores, or people just buying CDs, it doesn't even kind of go in depth enough. It's just sort of like, and then this thing started happening and none of us reacted quickly enough or the right way. And as a result, we were put out of business, you know, but it doesn't really speak to a larger issue. So I give it like a soft recommendation if you're interested in the subject matter. And I just like DVR'd that off of cable. I'm sure it's available for like digital rental. I don't think it's streaming anywhere right now, but I'm sure you can rent it off like Amazon Prime.
So what you're saying is you didn't pay money for it.
Well, I did because I subscribed to cable. So
you mean like people subscribe to Spotify, Patrick? I'm just saying you're part of the problem. That's all I'm saying.
I guess I am.
No, that's
guess
look.
I am.
You gotta change. Change with the times.
Yeah.
Look at us doing a podcast,
right?
Instead of coming to be going to people's houses,
talking about Ghostbusters
door,
for an hour,
talking about it.
People how do we handle the spoiler section on Willow Creek? Do we just send them to the kitchen for 2 minutes and 37 seconds?
I think like, so. I think people slam the door in our faces before
earmuffs.
We get that far.
I watched The Brothers Grimsby, which came out, I think, earlier this year. I couldn't even tell you if it's a 2016 or a 2015 release. Louis Leterrier directed it. He's an action film director. He made the District 13 movies and the original. No, he made. Did he do the. No, he didn't do the first Transporter. Maybe he did the. He did do the first Transporter. He's a pretty good French action director, branching out into sort of the action comedy. This is the movie that casts Sacha Baron Cohen and Mark Strong as long-lost brothers, one of whom is like a super spy assassin and one of whom is basically a soccer hooligan. And they team up for a mission, and it is staggeringly unfunny. And it was interesting because I feel like when Sacha Baron Cohen was doing Ali G, I felt like, wow, this is really interesting. This guy's a really kind of new comic voice. And when Borat came out, I really feel like it felt fresh and kind of exciting. And I recognize that, you know, he can't keep doing that because the jig is up. You know, that movie was so big that it became harder and harder for him to pass himself off as these characters or people to not realize that they were being pranked or whatever. So he does have to sort of reinvent himself, but every attempt he's made at reinventing himself, I think, since Borat has been pretty terrible. I was not a Bruno fan. I was not a fan of The Dictator. And The Brothers Grimsby, I would say, is easily his worst movie to date. It's a movie that gets most of its laughs from, like, elephant semen and Daniel Radcliffe getting AIDS. I think those are like the big jokes in the movie.
Oh, so like the seventh Harry Potter movie.
Correct. Correct. Okay. Yeah. So astonishingly unfunny, skip it at all costs. I saw The Secret Life of Pets because I have children, and it is the movie that actually defeated Ghostbusters at the box office this weekend in its second week of release. It still beat out Ghostbusters. It's making all of the money that Finding Dory is not making, and it's... I want to say it's fine, but A, that's become a cliche, and B, that might even be overstating it. It is essentially a remake of Toy Story, only with dogs instead of toys, except it has none of Toy Story's wit or heart. It just kind of goes through the motions of the plot. None of it really landed for me at all. I enjoyed Louis C.K. voicing the lead dog. I enjoyed Jenny Slate voicing one of the dogs. Like, there were a few voice actors that I liked hearing, but beyond that, I mean, if that's really what you're picking up on in the children's animated film, I feel like the movie might be falling short in the entertainment department. My kids were, you know, amused. They seemed to enjoy it, but I did not.
That's a shame.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
I mean, I it's probably not that much of a shame. It's okay.
And then the last movie that I'll talk about, because I wanted to recommend something, on Amazon Prime, they are streaming for free, if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, a 1990 or 1991 made for HBO movie directed by Martin Campbell, who would go on to make GoldenEye and Casino Royale and The Mask of Zorro, called Cast a Deadly Spell. And it is like a horror noir with Fred Ward playing a detective named Lovecraft in an alternate 1950s or late 40s Los Angeles in which everyone uses magic. It's just a foregone conclusion that everyone uses magic except for Detective Lovecraft. He's old school. He's not into using magic. And he's hired on a case to locate the Necronomicon. And Julianne Moore is in it. David Warner is in it. Somebody else whose name is not coming to me right now. Damn it. Anyway, it's terrific. I remember I was almost positive that I had seen it when it aired back in 1991 because it looked kind of like Clancy Brown. That's who I couldn't think of. It looked like the kind of thing that I wanted to see, but if I did see it, it either went over my head or I've completely forgotten it because watching it now was like watching a brand new movie. It was sequelized, I know, for HBO, a movie called Witch Hunt that Paul Schrader actually directed and Dennis Hopper took over, I think, as Detective Lovecraft. I've not yet seen Witch Hunt, but Cast a Deadly Spell is really... really great. It's I love the way it uses noir and kind of old school, you know, practical monster effects, a lot of like rubber monsters and stuff. But so much fun if you're a fan of both of those genres, and just really smart and really well done. And the transfer on the Amazon Prime stream is like unbelievable and made me really wish that they could get a Blu-ray. I know it's the kind of movie that would be perfect for Scream Factory, but I know they have trouble getting HBO's stuff because I think that's all held by Warner Brothers, who doesn't license anything. But check out Cast a Deadly Spell if you can.
I will.
Yeah.
I will. That sounds awesome.
I'm excited. I'm going to try to see Witch Hunt now, even though as much as I like Dennis Hopper, I don't feel like he's a replacement for Fred Ward. I would almost rather they were playing two different roles.
Yeah.
But whatever. Let's talk Ghostbusters.
Let's.
So I want to do my best to just talk about the movie and not necessarily compare it to the 1984 original, because I do think that the original film is not only maybe my favorite comedy ever made, but also just a true kind of lightning in a bottle situation that couldn't be replicated. I don't hold it against the 2016 Ghostbusters for not touching the 84 original, because I don't think any movie can. What works about it is so unique to that movie and is so special, and it works in so many different ways that it would be unfair for me to expect another movie to work the same way. So I'm going to try to review it just as a movie. I'm also going to try to review it independent of the controversy around it, where a bunch of men with minuscule dicks complained that they were destroying their childhoods by remaking Ghostbusters with an all-female cast, as though the fact that the Ghostbusters were played by men is the reason that it is a classic. But go ahead, I will let you have the opening remarks on 2016 Ghostbusters.
Okay. I agree with you that we can't talk about... We shouldn't look at the new Ghostbusters and compare it to the, you know, the original and say it's good or it's bad because the original did this or that. Because, at first, I think the original is a perfect movie. It'd be kind of like if, and I know one day they will, come up with a new Back to the Future. If it's good, I think it's fair to say it's good without saying it's not as good as Back to the Future, because the original Back to the Future is also a perfect movie.
Right.
I think it is appropriate to talk about, at least to some degree, the new Ghostbusters in light of the controversy, because I think watching the movie with that in mind actually helps the movie. Not help the movie, but there are things in the movie that seem to have clear parallels, whether purposeful or not, to the controversy surrounding it. And honestly, I mean, just that kind of controversy existed at all and continues to exist among people who hadn't seen the movie a week before it came out, but saw fit to attack critics who said it was anything other than a pile of trash. I think says a lot about, you know, the current climate in general, in Hollywood, and in the world, so I think it's totally fair to talk about it to some degree. I think we have plenty to talk about as far as the movie is concerned, but I think that is, for better or worse, part of the movie. The same way, I guess you could watch the Force Awakens and talk about, you know, the expectations and the hype surrounding a brand new Star Wars movie. For whatever reason, this 2016 Ghostbusters had similar kind of levels of interest, excitement, hype, and disappointment surrounding it that it really had nothing to do with the movie itself until now, because now the movie's out. I liked it a lot. I think this is a good movie. I like Paul Feig's movies very much. I don't think they're perfect, but I liked The Heat a lot. I liked Spy a lot last year. Bridesmaids I liked. I mean, they're all movies that none of which would be like, this is one of my favorite movies of all time, or the past decade, or whatever. But I laugh a lot. I like the characters. I always have fun when I watch a Paul Feig movie. I like Melissa McCarthy a lot. I've never had any reason to not like her. I'm definitely not one of those people who thinks anything bad about her at all. I think she's very good, and I think she's good in this movie. I think everyone who's in the movie is good. I think the script is funny. I think it's, you know, obviously it's not as good as the original. We can say that now. We already have. We're not going to compare, even though I just did. Sorry, but but I mean, it's a solid summer blockbuster comedy script, I have to wonder, and I'll say this now, although we can talk about it elsewhere. I wonder, even if we took the controversy and put it to the side, if it would be as hard to watch a movie that's a reboot like this without there being such wildly different opinions, would the opinions be a little bit more uniform if it wasn't a comedy? Because when it comes to what comedies, people's opinions about comedies vary wildly anyway. Sure. Comedy is so subjective. Sure. The fact that this is a comedy means that from the beginning, no matter whether it was a Ghostbusters movie or just a new Paul Feig movie, people were going to come away from it with very different experiences anyway.
Yeah,
I like the sense of humor. I thought it was funny. I could see people not finding it funny and either attributing that to it being a bad movie or to it being a movie full of girls. I had a lot of fun. I thought it was a good movie.
All right. One of the things that I do like about the movie and talking about it in terms of, okay, a couple things. One, I said I wasn't going to compare it to the original, and I truly will try not to. Although I will say that maybe one of my problems with the film is that it constantly invites comparison. Like a lot of remakes or reboots, it keeps referencing the original thing as though you're going to forget that that's what they're doing, that they're remaking Ghostbusters. At no point did I forget that they were remaking Ghostbusters or that it was a movie that I had already seen, and so I didn't need all of the callbacks. And a lot of times, unfortunately, what the effect that that has is it just makes me wish that I was watching the other thing, because the other thing is often going to be better. So I kind of wished they had toned down all of, I don't know if they thought they were doing fan service or if these were like cutesy little tributes. I don't know. But I felt like there were just too many unnecessary callbacks. And I'm not even talking about the cameos, which we can talk about maybe in spoilers. I'm talking about specific shots or characters that show up. In terms of the controversy, you know, it's one of the things that I like about the movie, because I agree with you that there are some specific things that the film does that seem to almost directly address the controversy. There are some other things that, I don't think this is a spoiler. There's a scene where characters are like reading comments on a YouTube video. And while I don't know it to be true, I'm 95% positive that they're just actual comments that they got when it was announced that they were rebooting Ghostbusters, that these were not things that they had to go out and write. They just found actual hateful things written on the internet. So scenes like that, you know, pay direct tribute to the whole thing. And then I think there are some indirect references as well. But one of the things that I do like about the movie, and that I've liked about all of Paul Feig's movies, honestly, is the gender essentially doesn't matter. You know, in Spy, Melissa McCarthy isn't, it's not like, oh, she's a great spy and a woman. It's like, she's a great spy and, but was working behind a desk. You could swap the gender of the character and it wouldn't make a huge difference. I think the fact that it is a woman does make it more progressive, but I don't think it's like built into the fabric of the film, you know? So I think the films are progressive in the way that they just present, hey, here are some female characters. And we're off and running. It's not like, let's make a big deal out of the fact that they're women. People are constantly giving them a hard time for being women. You can't be real scientists. You can't be Ghostbusters. You're girls. Like, there's none of that in the movie. Well, not a lot of that in the movie. So I do like that. Having said all of that, I'm disappointed that I don't like the movie more. And I'm not crazy about the movie. I think it's okay. I don't think it's like a terrible movie, but I definitely did not enjoy it as much as you did. And I'm disappointed by that, honestly, because I wanted it to be great, you know, because I always want a movie to be great, but also so that it would shut up some of the naysayers. I'm upset that it's opening at number two, which isn't a reflection on its quality, but gives these idiots more fuel, you know, to complain or say, we were right, haha. And I just, I want all of those people to go away forever and ever. So I'm disappointed by that. But yeah, I was with it for a little while. I thought it started fairly strong. And by the end, I think it just fell victim to what so many special effects comedies, you know, there are very few special effects comedies that work. You could count them on one hand, Ghostbusters being the most successful, and then like Men in Black and Galaxy Quest, and I might be running out, you know, that work. And I feel like this one falls victim to what most special effects comedies fall victim to, which is just it gets overwhelmed by the special effects and the comedy just completely falls by the wayside. I would say, of the, you know, because no one talks about Unaccompanied Minors when they talk about Paul Feig's filmography. That was his first film. But if we're just talking Bridesmaids, The Heat, Spy, and this one, I think this was my least favorite of the Paul Feig filmography.
Okay. I will, I, anticipated somewhat the kind of comments about the references. This is a movie, obviously, that has that does go out of its way to make reference to the original. I don't know how much of that comes from, you know, the Paul Feig and his co-screenwriter, whose name I'm blanking out at the moment.
Kate Dippold?
Yeah, that sounds right. You know, their affection for the original and wanting to put those nods in. I don't know how much of that is studio mandated, that kind of stuff. I will say I thought that the nods were mostly clever. They were obvious. They were definitely in your face. But I will say I think this movie actually had less fan service than something like The Force Awakens. I will say that. I think
it's probably true.
I mean, you know, and I mean, who knows? Maybe this is the same kind of thing. Like that movie, not a comedy. Like we can go into it thinking, okay, this is it's an action adventure. It's supposed to be fun, but not funny. So maybe there's less room for subjectivity and something like that. I don't know.
Well, I think that there's a distinction there in that The Force Awakens does take place in the same universe as the previous Star Wars films. So some of those signifiers are just a function of, hey, there's Han Solo, there's Chewbacca, because they exist in this universe, which is not true of Ghostbusters. And I think the other distinction is in terms of The Force Awakens, you know, part of its issue is that it just redoes so many of the beats. So while they're not necessarily like direct references, hey, look at this, remember this, there's definitely some of that. There's the Millennium Falcon, there's this. It's more just like you sit through the movie and you get a feeling of deja vu because you're like, well, didn't they already make this movie? Isn't this just Star Wars? And Ghostbusters does a little bit of that in terms of some of the plot beats, but even when it kind of carves its own path, it'll stop just to throw in something that, like, remember Slimer, you know? Literally, the movie stops. The movie actually stops. A car gets blocked in the road just so Slimer can appear. I hope that's not a spoiler. Right. I don't think it needs to do that because, again, the affection for the material... the affection for the original Ghostbusters should come through by virtue of the fact that they're remaking Ghostbusters.
Right. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, this is not the hill I'm going to die on when it comes.
No, obviously. You know, nor me.
I think, yeah. And they did not bother me. I think they will bother some people. They did not bother me at all. I was not as, you know, I didn't have the reaction that they probably wanted. Not like the people who are sitting behind me who are like, ooh, it's Slimer. Ooh, it's that. You know, not if you're listening, people behind me, you were wonderful. You didn't talk much. You were fine. But I mean, like, there was definitely, you know, they did it for people in the audience who go to a summer blockbuster, especially a sequel, and want to see those things. You know, they want to hear the greatest hits. This is not, you know, this reminds me a little bit of the review I wasn't going to talk about, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, which is entirely a movie of greatest hits. It is entirely, remember this from the first movie?
Right.
This from the first movie? And if you really like the first movie, you probably really like seeing it again. Like, you want to see those things again on the big screen. So if you want to see these nods to the original Ghostbusters, there you go. And if you didn't, it didn't take that much out of your time. So I'm okay with those nods. I think they did a pretty good job. Like, there were some things, we're not in spoilers, so I won't mention them. There's one that shows up on a billboard.
Yeah.
That I thought was fine.
That kind of stuff I don't.
That's pretty subtle. Like, they're not just remaking the original. They are throwing in nods to the original.
Right.
There are things that maybe twist a little bit too far to line up with what happened in the original.
Yes.
But nothing that is so, I don't know, nothing that really irked me, because it really is a lot of throwaway stuff that's just like, you know, nudging you in the ribs, and that's okay. I think that's okay.
The billboard thing is fine, and that kind of stuff, if they want to throw in, that is kind of little fan servicey stuff, and that's fine. It's those bigger things when the movie stops, or even a specific shot of a cloud forming around the top of a building that's taken directly from the 84 film. I'll save the most egregious one to me, the one that bothered me most, for spoilers, because it involves a scene that comes after the credits. And it really rubbed me the wrong way. And it's not even necessarily a problem with the movie Ghostbusters. It's more a symptom of a larger problem that we have in our current system of movie making. I like the cast. Almost everyone that shows up, I'm happy to see, you know, whether it's Charles Dance or Steve Higgins, Or somebody else.
You better say a woman's name, Patrick. You're getting real close to.
No, I liked it when the men showed up. That was my favorite part of the movie.
Well, the women have the really big roles.
I'm kidding.
And again, speaking to the four leads, I like all four of those actresses. I was a little bit frustrated because, and here's the one area where I truly will compare it to the 84 film. Aside from the lack of any kind of good score, which bothered me, because one of the things that's so great about the 84 film is how great the score is. And this movie's score is just 100% generic and features no less than, I think, four covers of the Ray Parker Jr. song. The one thing that I'll say is that when they sat down to say, let's remake Ghostbusters, which, you know, is somebody had to do it, right? Because Sony was hell-bent on reviving this property. It's a big moneymaker for them. Their plan was to turn it into a shared universe, much like Marvel, as evidenced by the Ghost Corps title card at the beginning of the film, you know, a division of Sony or whatever. That, I will say, kind of filled me with rage because, again, it's a symptom of, like, this doesn't need to be a shared universe. It doesn't need its own little production company, its own title card. Like, make a good movie. Just worry about that. And then, you know, you want to branch out, go ahead. Make a good movie. So somebody had to do it. I'm glad it was Paul Feig. I'm glad that he took it in this direction rather than just having four generic white guys. You know, here's Seth Rogen and Jonah Hill. And, you know, that's kind of what they were talking about early on. Yeah. And it was going to be like the new class. They're trained by the old Ghostbusters. None of that could interest me less, you know.
So I'm so glad they didn't do that. That would have been the worst.
So I'm glad they took it in this direction. I'm glad they recast it. And all that stuff is great. But the thing that they didn't do when they sat down to say what was special about Ghostbusters, it's not just the way that it combines comedy and special effects. It's not just the idea of, like, people catching ghosts. It's that specifically those main three actors, and I'm not counting Ernie Hudson here, who I like in the movie, but I'm talking about Ramis and Aykroyd and Bill Murray. All three create very distinct characters from one another, who have very distinct personalities that feel lived in, and each finds a very different way to be funny. And that, to me, is what's special about the original Ghostbusters. And, of course, you could even break it down to one is the heart, one is the brain, and one is the mouth, which is sort of how that character breakdown, you know, happens in the original Ghostbusters. And I will say I'm glad that in this new one, they didn't just say, like, okay, you're the Venkman, okay, you're the Spangler, and you're the Stans. They're not trying to create just character proxies, but I don't think they really created distinct characters. I'd say Kristen Wiig is like 50 to 75% of the way there. They try to give her some backstory and some motivation, but I think the idea is only kind of half formed. It doesn't really resolve, I don't think. To me, the only person who really creates a character and has proven to be, I think, the most polarizing in the cast is Kate McKinnon. Mm-hmm. I've heard people say she's the funniest thing in the movie and she steals it. I've heard people say she's the worst thing in the movie. She's mugging and distracting and I couldn't stand her. I lean towards the former. Mm-hmm. She made me laugh almost every time she was on screen and had reactions to things that were completely different than what anybody else was doing, and yet created a character that you believed that's how that character would react. You know, it was like everything she did made sense to the character that she created. So you could always be looking to her at any given moment and saying, oh yeah, that's totally what she would do. And she's not given a ton of screen time. You know, she's definitely more of a supporting Ghostbuster. Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig are kind of the leads. But to me, Kate McKinnon is really the only one who creates a fully formed character. And that was a big disappointment to me because, again, I like all four of these actors. I think all of them can be very, very funny in the right material. And I didn't feel like this movie gave them that material.
I disagree a little bit. I found them to be distinctive. Where I would agree, and I think this probably speaks as much to, you know, modern comedies as it does anything else, is that I didn't get that lived-in feel, like you say, with the original Ghostbusters, which we're not comparing this movie to, by the way. But no, I mean, I think everyone kind of had their own approach. I like that Leslie Jones was a big history nerd for New York history. Like, that was her big – or we're not in spoilers.
But would you agree
that's not a spoiler, but yeah.
Would you agree that that's not – they don't do anything with that?
Well, they do that a little bit. I mean, she well, it ties into, you know, her figuring out, you know, where things are going on and the significance of certain places. I mean, it doesn't not factor in. I mean, there are comedies where that kind of thing would be a complete throwaway, and I don't think that's the case here.
I think it's a little bit built in as a way of justifying her participation in the Ghostbusters, which is okay. We'll get back to one of my other issues with the film, is just how expository it feels the need to be, where it has to explain the genesis of everything, including the logo.
I'm going to pause for 1 second. At what point are we going to move into spoilers?
Very soon, very soon.
Okay, all right.
So, you know, I already kind of think it's weird that they've marginalized the one person of color in the cast, like the only one who's not a scientist, and they justify her participation because she knows New York, right? So there's a few kind of lip service-y lines where she knows New York, but to me it just seemed like another half-formed idea. And there's a scene later in the film, and I don't think this is a spoiler, and I'm sorry if this is, where they're looking at a map, and they're drawing some lines on a map because they're figuring something out. And to me, there's a perfect opportunity, because they're calling out like, oh, where's this place and where's this place? And Leslie Jones takes no part in that scene. And to me, that's the scene where you let her step up and put all that stuff together. That kind of justifies that backstory. Oh, she's a New York history nerd. She knows this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, if you let that her expertise actually figure into the plot, that at least, I think, kind of rounds that character out a little bit. And by not doing that, I think we just get a lot of, you know, Leslie Jones in terms of personality. It's like she shouts, you know, that's her function on the team is like to shout. And Melissa McCarthy, like, is enthusiastic, but in terms of describing her personality, I don't think I can. And that's why it doesn't feel totally distinctive to me. I don't think, you know, she falls back on what people claim is the Melissa McCarthy shtick, which is like to be vulgar or to fall down, even though I think she doesn't do that in every movie, but for some reason she's kind of pigeonholed as doing that. She does none of that here. She's very sweet, which I like. But I just don't feel like they've given her enough of a character. It's almost like we cast Melissa McCarthy and our work is done.
Okay. I guess I can see some of that. I mean, I could certainly see an argument for involving Leslie Jones in that scene. But I don't know. I got enough of the sense of her, you know. I mean, look, you don't want to stereotype her as, you know, let's not fall back on that old black stereotype, you know, New York history buff. Okay. And so I think she can be a little bit more than just a history buff, Patrick. That's all I'm saying. But
I think she should have at least been a history buff.
She was. I think there were plenty of scenes where she talks. I mean, she brings it out. But that doesn't have to define her character. Like, if you want to make her lived in, you know, have that be a thing that she does, but don't make it the only thing she does. She pops in to say, you know, that building was built in 1853. Thanks, Leslie Jones.
I don't want it to be the only thing that she does. I just think.
I think a lot of the things you're describing are problems in general with modern comedies. And I think with Paul Feig comedies as well. I mean, it comes from a very specific kind of comedic point of view. Like, everyone has a character. I mean, all the actors, the main actors, are all on Saturday Night Live at some point. I haven't watched in a while.
Melissa McCarthy has guest hosted.
Okay. So I guess she wasn't. But, no. But Leslie Jones is or was on Saturday Night Live?
Is. Kate McKinnon is. Okay. And Kristen Wiig was.
Gotcha. Okay. So, I mean, this definitely fits into that kind of modern character comedy structure of coming up with a character who does a thing. I think they do a better job than just being, you know, having the one catchphrase and having, you know, the one funny vocal affectation. But, you know, they're not, and again, we're not comparing this to the original, but I mean, you know, they're not going to be those kind of characters. I mean, if you look at what Saturday Night Live was back in the 70s, leading up to when Murray and Aykroyd were on it, I mean, that was a show that would occasionally, in the last half hour, throw in a completely dramatic, unfunny scene. I remember a scene, it was Gilda Radner, and I forget who she was with, in like a tenement, and it was just a dramatic short piece. Have you ever seen that? I mean, that's kind of what Saturday Night Live was in the 70s. Now it's very different. So I think that the comedy landscape has changed. I'm not trying to minimize your complaints. I don't think you're wrong. It would be great if we got more backstory, if we got more of a sense of who these characters are. But as far as the tone of the movie, as far as what the movie's trying to do, as far as what most modern studio comedies are trying to do, remake or reboot or not, I think it's in line with all that, you know. And so it kind of sucks that we have to come down to, is it funny or is it not funny? Is it Ghostbusters or is it not Ghostbusters?
Right.
But I mean, I think a lot of those complaints, none of that bothered me. And I guess, again, this comes down to, like, you watch a comedy. Was it funny? Did you like the movie? If so, you're probably going to forgive some of those things. Did you not like it? Did you not laugh? And you're probably going to hate a lot of what you see.
Right.
And that's, unfortunately, you know, what watching a movie can be like.
Well, and I, you know, as a comedy, I didn't laugh as much as I wanted to. And it sounds like maybe not as much as you. And when I even talk about the character stuff, again, it does more than a lot of modern comedy. I haven't yet seen Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. You know, do I think that there's probably more character building in Ghostbusters than in Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates? Yes. So maybe it's one of these things where the movie is just good enough for me to wish it was much better.
Sure.
It's not so bad where I'm just like, forget it. This is a wash. Who cares? There's enough there that I'm like, just do this and this, and then it's better. Because I'm, you know, when I talk about the lack of characters, I'm really talking about it more just in terms of whether or not it works as a movie, whether or not there was an 84 Ghostbusters or not, you know.
Sure.
And talking about the modern comedy landscape, I'll make this kind of complaint, and then we can get into spoilers. Because it's not just true of Ghostbusters, it's true of most modern comedies, unfortunately. Paul Feig, you know, created Freaks and Geeks, worked with Judd Apatow. Judd Apatow produced Feig's kind of breakout movie Bridesmaids. So the two come from, I think, a similar school. They work with a number of the same actors. And they both rely heavily on improvisation, I think, in terms of constructing their scenes. They cast really funny people, allow them to ad-lib. It's one of the reasons why you can watch the Blu-rays of the films, and there's hours of outtakes and alternate lines and bloopers and all this stuff, because the actors are on set just creating all the time. And that's fine. And, it, you know, I think it leads to some really, really funny stuff. But it has an unfortunate side effect, and that is it leads to really poor editing. And unfortunately, I think Ghostbusters is a really badly edited film, and I think it's a result of, again, having all of this footage. We have all these takes. We want to use this joke from this take and maybe this reaction from this take, and then there's just a cutaway because we have to patch these two takes together. And so it feels very sloppy, and it always bothers me, you know, with Apatow movies. It bothered me with Neighbors 2 earlier this year. I think one of the reasons it bothers me more with Paul Feig's movies, even though I think they are funny, and I've liked all of them to varying degrees. Like I said, unfortunately, Ghostbusters is probably my least favorite. But Feig is working, especially with his last two movies and now this one, he's working in very specific genres. The Heat is his buddy cop movie. Spy is obviously his spy movie. This is, you know, a Ghostbusters movie, special effects comedy, whatever you want to call it. And I think that in doing that, you know, those genres have their own kind of movie language. They require a certain amount of formalism. Now, I'm not expecting Edgar Wright levels of technical precision, but that's part of what we respond to in Edgar Wright's films. is not only is he working, again, in specific genres, but his films are incredibly technically precise. And Feig's movies feel sloppy, unfortunately. And I think that that editing and that by approaching the comedy that way, I think it steps on what he's doing in terms of that genre framework or in terms of building his film within the context of a larger genre. You know, Spy ends up being like a bad action movie, even when it's being funny. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. I mean, I cannot defend this as a, you know, I mean, I'm not going to go to bat for the, you know, filmmaking prowess of Paul Feig or certainly Judd Apatow, who I generally, while I enjoy the movies that I watch, just feel like they go on forever.
Oh, yeah. No, they do, especially the last few. Although Trainwreck, I thought was really solid.
Yeah, no, Trainwreck was good. Trainwreck was good. Yeah, no, it seems like, unfortunately, you know, this is definitely not the best movie I've seen this year or anything like that. But I, so it comes down to, did I think it was funny? Did I think it worked well? And do I think that the things that could be seen as problems bothered me? And those things didn't as much as they did you. And
right.
This
is me actually working out my feelings in the process of talking about them. But it's one of those things where like, if I thought it was funnier, I could forgive the sloppiness. And because I didn't think it was that funny, I don't want it to be so slow. You know what I mean? Like if it was made, I could forgive it for being not as funny and by being, to me, not super funny and also kind of sloppily made. Mm-hmm. Those two things, unfortunately, exacerbate one another. But let's go ahead and move into spoilers for the 2016 remake of Ghostbusters. If you've not seen the movie, go ahead and tune out now. Or if you don't care about having it spoiled for you, go ahead and keep listening. Should we just do another 2 minutes, 37 seconds then of spoilers?
I think that's about as much time as we need. No, I want to go back to something that you said about...
I said a lot.
You said a lot. You said a lot, Patrick. A lot of hurtful things. But I just want to talk about one of them right now. You complained, you pointed out that the movie does a lot to kind of explain the origins of certain things. I thought they did a good job with that. And I you know, maybe, you know, the first movie, the original movie, does none of that, really. I mean, you get little bits and pieces. It's mostly comes out of the characters. You know, they never explain how they build, you know, the packs. They never explain, you know, how any of that stuff works. And
did you ever find that to be a problem, though?
No, I didn't. And but I don't think that the new movie does it in such a way that I feel like, well, they feel like they have to do it. I mean, there are countless movies, prequels especially, where it feels like they have to explain where something came from.
That's the only reason they exist, is like to get us to the place where we already know where we started.
Yeah. And I think one of the smartest things about the movie, although it does create that disconnect when it comes to the references and some of the cameos, is that this does not take place in the same, apparently does not take place in the same New York as the original Ghostbusters. There is a throwaway line in the mayor's office about how people forget and they move on after a little while.
Right.
That almost seems like a nod to maybe this is and everyone's forgotten.
Right.
But I mean, basically, this isn't the new class. This isn't a prequel. This isn't even really a remake. It's just, here's Ghostbusters. It's different this time.
Right.
And so when they kind of explain those things, all of those things, I mean, even the graffiti in the subway, giving us the logo. I mean, it all kind of worked within the context of the scene for me. And I think all of that fit in with what they were trying to show us. I mean, Kate McKinnon, super, you know, talented engineer and really into what she does. So as she's developing this stuff and she's talking about how it works, it's because she's super excited about the things that she's coming up with and them trying to solve problems about how do we do this stuff. And it's not about how do we catch ghosts to make money at first. It's how do we, you know, capture something, bring it back to the lab so we can prove that we're not crazy people. Which I think is an interesting take on the whole thing.
I wish that it had gone further with that again, because if the original film is kind of about this idea of capitalism, I like the idea. And again, it's so many things in the movie to me only go halfway. You know, it's like they introduce an interesting concept and then just kind of give up on it or it falls short.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like they introduce that to get things, to get the ball rolling. And maybe it is just a way to get us to the point where they're saving the world. But it's to me, that's a fine reason for them to be doing what they're doing.
Well, no, that's what I was going to say, is that this isn't about capitalism. It's more about that the central argument is sort of the denial of science in mm-hmm. a way. I mean, it's obviously combining sort of the scientific and the metaphysical, but their whole thing is like, no one believes us. We're trying to tell people that something is real and everyone's denying it, which I think has real world implications. You know, I think mm-hmm. it's a commentary on some things that are actually taking place in the world, which I like. I just wish that, again, some of those ideas were kind of threaded throughout the movie a little bit more cleanly so that I don't feel like sometimes I'm reaching to pull some of that out.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, it certainly seems like that's what the movie uses to get to the point where we introduce the, you know, villain and the whole, you know, his plan.
Right.
Which is, I mean, that what you just said about, you know, how these scientists who are also women have to go out of their way to try to convince people that they're, you know, have an authoritative
credible
voice.
Incredible. Right.
I mean, I think that has as much to say about women as it does about science.
Sure.
I don't think the whole movie, the movie's not about the controversy, but there are things in the movie that I think speak to where the controversy comes from. Really the villain, and I'm blanking on his name, Neil
Rowan.
Rowan, thank you. He is basically the sad, lonely nerd sitting in his parents' basement writing bad, you know, bad YouTube comments. And I know that, you know, sorry, he's probably not living with his parents. He's probably, you know, Airbnb being something or other. I don't know if people do these days. But I didn't want to feed into that stereotype.
Right.
It's not about stereotypes. You're right about the micropenises, but other than that, I don't want to no stereotypes. But you know, I mean, he is basically like the angry loner man who feels like he's just put upon and everyone is out to get him. And then they have that scene where they confront him, you know, midway through the movie where it feels like the climax, but it's not. And all the women are like, yeah, we get that every day.
Right.
You know, and so, I mean, that kind of stuff, it's not about the controversy, but it's very true. And it sort of is interesting to see in light of the controversy surrounding the movie.
And again, to me, felt like another of these kind of half-formed ideas, that there's enough of it there that we can say, like, yeah, Rowan is essentially this guy who is bullied and so is therefore going to lash out against, you know, the female remake of Ghostbusters or whatever. But he's also just kind of a shitty generic villain. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't think that his stuff really worked, and I really dislike, and whatever, we can just, you know, maybe it's just a matter of taste, but like at the end when he turns into the logo, I just was like, ugh, this is such a bad idea.
I thought it was fine. I mean, it's one of those things where like I have to be like, yeah, I thought it was fine. I mean, I didn't like, and I can 100% see if someone, you, anyone else, people who reacted more, you know, negatively to the movie, did not like this, did not like that kind of stuff. None of that bothered me at all. I thought it was, I thought it worked. I thought it was, you know, fine. I thought Rowan was, you know, his plan was enough to keep things moving. And again, maybe I'm grading this whole thing on a curve because that's kind of what I expect. You know, I mean, I don't expect much from summer blockbusters. I don't expect much from comedies generally.
But don't you expect a lot from like Paul Feig and this cast?
Sure. And
I do.
But at the same time, is like the only thing about this movie that doesn't feel Paul Feig to me is that it's PG-13, I assume. And so they're not swearing all
right,
the time.
Right.
So, I mean, like, if it really were a Paul Feig movie, like, if he was, like, there were no, I assume, constraints for, you know, the contract you sign when you say, I'm going to make a Ghostbusters movie, you can do this or can't do that. If it was really a Paul Feig movie, I think it would be, you know, probably better and more interesting than it is now. But I still think it works well enough within that context. And we're seeing a lot of, you know, movies by, you know, talented filmmakers who are working within some sort of franchise system. And Ghostbusters is you know, it's not a franchise yet. You know, it's you know, one movie, a sequel that's not very good. You know, whatever, I liked it when I was a kid, and then this movie, right? So it's you know, so I guess he's been given something that has a lot of nostalgia and could very well be the beginning of a whole new thing. You know, you think of what could have been, like we all, you know, wrung our hands when Edgar Wright gave up Ant-Man, but who knows what that would have been. I assume if it's Edgar Wright, it's going to be better, you know, than most, but is it really going to be an Edgar Wright movie within the Marvel system? I don't know. Is this going to be a Paul Feig movie within the Sony Ghostbusters system? And that's a different kind of thing to be disappointed by, for sure. And 100% I'm with you. But I mean, everything in it, I thought it all kind of flowed well. I didn't feel a lot of really kind of weird, jarring plot stuff. Honestly, it took a while for me to warm up to the movie, like the very beginning. I liked the opening scene. I thought Zach Woods was very funny, and that whole,
that was my favorite stuff in the movie.
Yeah. And I mean, that was like that was a good, I mean, pretty much from after that, up through the next scene that takes place, in that mansion, with the ghost vomiting the slime, like all that stuff I didn't love. Like even Kate McKinnon, who I ended up really liking by the end of the movie and just finding completely charming and, you know, such a complete performance.
Yeah.
I mean, when she first came on, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like her. You know, I was like, I don't know if I can do this. And there are people who never got past, you know,
right.
Their reaction never changed from that. Mine did. So like, the beginning of the movie, wasn't the strongest part of the movie for me. It was kind of, you know, the midway through and even to the end, I thought the third act was, again, fine. Like I'm usually bothered by third acts in movies. I wasn't. Maybe I was transported enough that it carried me through. And it's just this, you know, we have this fine gossamer thread in filmmaking. That's just, if you grab onto it and it doesn't break, then you get carried through the end and there you go. That's great. And all this time we still haven't talked about Chris Hemsworth.
Oh yeah.
Who is so funny in the movie. I thought, I mean, I think his stuff is so funny. I don't want to say he's the funniest thing in the movie because I think he doesn't, you know, he doesn't work without the, you know, the full performances given by the actresses. But, I mean, you know, playing saxophone or listening to saxophone, like that kind of stuff.
I thought he had a lot of funny kind of throwaway lines. Yeah. The scene where they're interviewing him, where, you know, Kristen Wiig is so clearly hitting on him, was an interesting inversion of a scene that we've seen a million times in like 80s and 90s comedies where it's the hot girl being interviewed by the guys. I don't know if just inverting it is progressive or is it just as guilty of being that kind of thing, except with the gender swapped. I don't know. But I did like that they kind of, you know, Kristen Wiig is kind of super attracted to him and throwing stuff out, but like that's something that they didn't feel like they needed to see through or like they end up together or anything like that. I appreciated that. That was one of those things where like it's just a character thing. It provides some laughs, but like we don't need closure on that. Again, I think in the second half of the film, which to me works less than the first half, because that's when it gets into kind of the plot stuff and it relies a little heavily on Rowan. And I think just the special effects at the end, you know, I think are just, again, guilty of, I guess I should just say the effects so that Adam Riske doesn't get upset because he says, don't call them special effects. They're not special. it's an example of more is less. You know, it's overwhelmed with CG. I like that it's all kind of neon colored. It's bright and it looks different than some other stuff that we've been seeing lately. But again, because we can do anything in a movie now with computers, we do. And so we have Rowan stomping through the streets of New York, destroying buildings just because he can, you know. And we have lots and lots of colorful ghosts and we get a sequence where the Ghostbusters are badasses and they use their new weapons, and that's fine. I mean, they're paying off something that they've been building up. To me, it's really starts to lose the thread. And honestly, the Chris Hemsworth stuff doesn't work as well for me because I think this idea of Rowan, disembodied Rowan, possessing people, A, has been given away in all of the marketing, and B, is another one of these half-formed ideas. Like, he jumps into Melissa McCarthy for a scene. then he jumps into Chris Hemsworth for like two scenes and then jumps out. And it's like, it's one of those things that either they need to do it more or not at all.
I was glad that they didn't drag out the Melissa McCarthy.
No, me too. I don't need to see her being possessed by an evil guy. You know, I want to see her being Melissa McCarthy.
I do need to see that, but that's okay.
Well, you want to see that character just being that character. You don't want to see her being evil. Obviously they cut a whole dance number from the film, which I think might have been the right call. You know, like I don't feel like the movie was missing a dance number.
Nope.
But again, just speaks to that there was too much in the movie. Like they needed to cut some stuff out. I don't know. I thought the whole Rowan possessing people needed to either be done more or not at all. And I thought the Chris Hemsworth stuff where he's like, hey, I'm a Ghostbuster and now I'm possessed. It felt rushed and almost a little bit like an afterthought or like a reshoot. And I know it wasn't a reshoot, but it just had that feel to it.
Here comes old man Brownlee talking about special effects again.
But I will agree with you that a lot of the Chris Hemsworth super deadpan straight face, like throwaway lines like aquariums or submarines for fish, were very funny.
Yep.
And I have to bring up the first scene again because I truly perked up because I didn't know what to expect from the film. And I was being as open-minded as I could. But I will admit that the five trailers that played before Ghostbusters reminded me of how frustrated I am with a lot of current movies because it was one after another that I'm like, oh, that looks terrible. I don't want to see that. Why are they cutting trailers together this way? Why is Nerve a movie? And I was just getting frustrated. So when Ghostbusters started, I was like,
See now in my small theater, I only saw like two or three trailers. So I think that probably
that made all the difference.
I mean, there are sometimes I go to that theater, I see no trailers at all. It's a beautiful thing. Nice. Anyway,
but Zach Woods had like three or four jokes right in a way that were super throwaway, super deadpan. They almost sounded like Tina Fey, 30 Rock, just like, here's where P.T. Barnum first had the idea to enslave elephants. And I was like, oh, wait, this movie's actually going to be really funny in like a really fast way, in a way that isn't broad, that doesn't call attention to the jokes. And I won't say that it became broad or called attention to the jokes later, but the jokes were certainly way more spaced out. And it does too often rely on this thing that, to me, Anchorman kind of codified, which is like someone makes a joke and then the other person has to call attention to the joke and that becomes the joke.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm, do you know what I mean?
No, totally.
And this Ghostbusters did that a lot, I thought. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if just dancing to DeBarge is funny in and of itself, but then to just have the character comment on dancing to DeBarge is no funnier. And there's a lot of that going on.
I mean, that specific scene I think was kind of where I was like, oh, this Kate McKinnon, like she's got some moves. I mean that like in that scene where she's dancing, but also in that kind of way that every once in a while you get a comedic actor who just uses their entire body in a way that has a rhythm and timing to it that is special. And I think that she has that throughout the movie, and that is like, wow, that scene kind of captured that, you know, in a way that maybe isn't completely necessary to the plot, but still I think is it's a good scene. I think you could probably look at the Rowan stuff as, here's a guy, you know, I'll come up with a reason for it. Here's a guy who never liked being himself. Now he wants to be other people. Like now he like, of course he wants to be Chris Hemsworth. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's maybe not enough justification to have it in the movie, but it's enough for me to say, okay, that's fine. That makes sense. Like there's nothing about it that's jarring to me or inorganic. It's surface. I mean, this is a movie that exists largely on the surface, like, unfortunately, a lot of summer movies. But I like this more than most summer movies I watch or have, you know, that I've seen. Like, I've seen a lot of bad summer movies. I don't want this to be, you know, a conversation about summer movies versus not summer movies. And these are real movies and these are summer movies and that kind of thing. Because you know, you can have that conversation. You can go in with different expectations. And obviously, the expectations you go into a movie with are hugely important because that'll determine often whether you like something you would otherwise or not like something that you would have otherwise. But I guess I went in with, you know, blind enough. Like I think I watched one of the trailers. I didn't follow a lot of the marketing. So I didn't know that he was going to be possessing people in the movie. I saw something way early on about that big ghost logo being the bad guy, but I didn't know that that was going to – I didn't know how that was going to manifest itself.
Right.
So, I mean, I was surprised enough by what I saw. Not that it was, like, you know, shocking or hugely inventive, but, you know, it kept me engaged and interested. I thought they did a good job of paying things off later on. Things that seemed small came back. I mean, you know, some of it's a bit on the nose. I mean, the Swiss Army knife and that kind of stuff, which I thought was a you know, if you're going to bring back the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, that's probably a pretty good way to do it.
And that bothered me. The Swiss Army knife bothered me less than the jump into the vortex and grab Melissa McCarthy and say, like, I'm not going to leave you again, which is like, are you really trying to close this hole that you introduced 2 hours ago and then really haven't dealt with since? This is no longer a rift in their relationship. So to try to bring closure to it with that line to me was like, wow, this is so out of place in this movie. Like, I'd much rather you make a joke there.
That's ham-handed, but it's also like, that's what I expect from the climax of a summer movie. I hate to say it again, but like, I mean, I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. It was fine, TM.
The Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, bringing that back, you know, whatever. Again, it's a reference to the last movie that doesn't work as well because, again, that's threaded throughout the original film. Sigourney Weaver has a bag of them, and there's a story behind it when Dan Aykroyd tells the story. So its presence makes sense. Here it's there just because we saw 84 Ghostbusters. Whatever, I can forgive it because I do like Kate McKinnon's line.
But it's also not just randomly a ghost.
It's an actual inflatable, right?
And I liked those parade ghosts. I thought that was kind of an interesting effect.
Well, I also liked that they weren't just trapping every ghost; that it was more about just like making them explode. And I forgive the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man thing because I thought Kate McKinnon's line, like, "This is exactly how I picture myself dying," was funny enough. Yeah. I take, you know, a little bit of issue again with Rowan, not just because he's the logo brought to life, but because, again, it was like, they sat down, we're going to remake Ghostbusters. We can't just have the climax be the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. So what should we do? I know. The Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, we'll just give him a different form and call him something else. But it's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man again, you know. Sure.
Or it's the Statue of Liberty. I mean.
Right, exactly. And I'm not a Ghostbusters 2 fan at all. So, but yeah, same thing. Back up, I wanted to say something about the Chris Hemsworth thing. You know, again, it's one of these things where I like the idea that once Rowan is possessing Kevin, that he's like, oh, this is who I always wanted to be. And isn't there's, again, just kind of lip service paid to this idea of like, life is easier when you look like this. And I just, it's one of these things where it kind of introduces an idea that then it quickly forgets, you know.
I mean, how much do you really want the movie to pay off these ideas? It seems like introducing them enough that you recognize them at least gives you something to think about. I don't feel like these are giant plot threads that they're leaving dangling. They're just here's an idea that we're putting into the movie.
I think things
are harder for women than they are for men, scientists or not. But at the same time, it doesn't matter that these are women. You know, that she has to work. Kristen Wiig has to work really hard to get tenure at Columbia. Probably in part, even though it's kind of unsafe, because she's a woman.
But I think a good movie, I think Paul Feig has made three of them prior to this, completes the thought. And this movie never completes the thought. You know what I mean? By just bringing something up, that's not enough for me to say, like, okay, you get a pass for bringing it up. Yeah. Because I think his other films complete the thought, and this one doesn't.
Some of that may just be the fact that this is this is a movie that has to tick a lot of boxes.
Absolutely.
And you know, that does not excuse the movie. That does not mean, okay, we should give it a pass. That doesn't mean that at all.
Right.
But I mean, given the constraints, given the pressures, given the stuff, you know, I mean, I think it's not unfair to grade it a little bit on a curve. And it's not like I walked out of the movie saying, I didn't love it, but he tried. I mean, I legitimately had a good time.
Yeah,
I think you go to the movies, you enjoy yourself, or you find things that you don't like and that makes it harder for you to enjoy what you're seeing, or whatever. You're either transported or you're not. And I thought it was funny and I had a good time with it, and you didn't have as good a time with it as I did. I don't think either of us are saying that it's I'm not saying it's a fantastic movie. You should definitely see it. It's the best I've seen in years. And you're not saying it's complete trash. Don't
right.
bother.
Right.
So, I mean, we're, you know, I think we're probably not that far off. It's right. just that I think I thought the jokes were a little bit funnier than you did. And that's kind of about, you know, where it lands. So
what did you think of the cameos?
I mean, I wasn't super taken with them. I think they were fine because they're short. I mean, Bill Murray has the most to do. And
don't you feel like they should have left his to just the TV show?
Probably, although it does.
What's the payoff of his second scene?
Well, it kind of, I mean, that's probably the scene that begins to, that ties up or continues the thought of we're capturing ghosts because we want to study them because right. of the science. And that, I mean, so that, I think without that scene or without a scene like it, it does just transition immediately to, or we're just catching ghosts now. That's the scene that's about, you know, we've caught a ghost.
Right.
That's, you know, this is huge, not because we have, you know, badass lasers and we're, you know, the Ghostbusters again, but because it's, we finally have the proof we've been looking for all these years. You know, I mean, his, that scene doesn't play out great. I don't necessarily love or think that Kristen Wiig's motivations in that scene make a lot of sense. You know, sure, she wants to finally shut someone up and prove that she's a real scientist. I don't know that she would necessarily do it that way, but
right.
I mean, it was fine. I mean, the cameos were all a bit jarring, but again, I think it's that sort of, you know, play Freebird type of moment. I can't begrudge anyone who was charmed by that stuff. At least they're short, or at least they're quick.
Dan Aykroyd's was the roughest for me because he has to shoehorn in, like, I ain't afraid of no ghost.
Yes.
Harold Ramis's for me was the only one that worked.
Yep.
I thought that was very nice. And Ernie Hudson's felt kind of shoehorned in because the movie's trying to end at that point.
Yeah.
And again, here's an example of a movie that I think, like you said, because of, I think, I'm sure there are plenty of stories about Paul Feig having to turn in a specific product for Sony, because it is a movie that is often fighting with itself up to the end, where we get just kind of a whimper of a last scene where, okay, Ernie Hudson shows up and it's supposed to be ending on a joke where they're arguing about a hearse, and then it just cuts to the credits and you're like, well, that was really kind of a wet fart of an ending. And then we get a weird shoehorned in Sigourney Weaver cameo, which, fine, okay.
Right.
It's amusing. It feels weird. But as like a post-credits little cookie, I'm fine with that. What I take bigger issue with is that then, about a third of the way through the credits, we get the movie's proper ending, which is they go out to the roof and the whole skyline says, like, I love the Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And they're all standing there together and the film fades to black. And it's, you know, pretty genuinely sweet. And it's like, that's the ending of your movie, not that stupid Ernie Hudson scene.
Yeah.
So why does it have to take place in the middle of the credits? You know, whose decision is this? I don't know. Is that Paul Feig? Yeah. Is that the studio?
I don't know that. I mean, this almost feels like someone came up with a brand new model for post credit sequences. Like, here's an inter-credit sequence. I mean, like, pretty much the whole credits, and we left partway through the dance number, so I don't know if there's anything after that. I assumed there wasn't because they turned on all the lights and began to clean up.
Oh, no, there 100% is. I
didn't see it. What's after it?
Oh, it's the thing that pisses me off more than anything in this movie.
Oh, no wonder I like the movie so much. What is it?
So, yeah, I don't understand why we have to shoehorn in that scene during the credits. Like, put that at the end of your movie, fade to black, end movie, then you put the Sigourney Weaver scene after, you have the credits during the dance, all that stuff is fine, but like, don't be in such a rush to get to the credits that you can't bring closure to your movie. So the credits end, and we come back up on the Ghostbusters firehouse, which, again, is unnecessary, but okay, we got to get them in the firehouse, because is that part of Ghostbusters? I guess it is. I didn't mind that they were above a Chinese restaurant, you know?
Yeah.
And they're sitting around, and Leslie Jones is listening to some headphones, and they say, are you hearing anything? And she says, yeah, guys, what's Gozer? Cut to black.
Oh, really?
And it filled me with so much rage because, it's a horrible callback to the original film. And are there, surely there are people in the audience who are like, oh, yes. Like, A, it suggests we're doing a sequel. It's more of this shared universe Sony bullshit. And B, the implication is like, oh, in the next movie, they're going to do Gozer. Gozer is not what makes Ghostbusters great. Gozer is hardly canon. You could have named that anything. Do you know what I mean? It's JB and he said JB turned to me. He's like, oh, I guess the next movie they're going to do Khan, you know, and it's the exact same thing.
Yeah,
it's like,
that's too bad.
You don't just have to go back to the original. It made me so angry again, not in terms of this being a bad Ghostbusters movie. That's what I was referencing earlier when I said it's a thing that it's symptomatic of our larger problem with this kind of IP filmmaking where we're building universes and franchises instead of making movies. It really bothered me just in terms of like the state of blockbuster filmmaking, not, you know, it didn't actually affect my enjoyment of this Ghostbusters movie.
Yeah. No, that feels like your normal average kind of unnecessary post-credit sequence.
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't see that. That doesn't, okay, I take it back. Let's go back. Let's re-record this. I hate this movie. I hate it. I there's nothing I liked about it. No. I mean, that's too bad. I mean, that I really, really like that the movie is not a continuation of the original. I really like that it is its own thing. And there's no, you know, there's no reason. Hopefully they don't do Gozer. Hopefully they come up with some other Syrian demigod to, you know, 'cause there's a lot of you know, evil spirits in the world. I don't know if you know this, Patrick.
There's a limitless number of things you can just make up.
You absolutely. Instead of Gozer, it's Dozer.
Right. It's not like in comic book movies where they reference something and you're like, oh, they're going to do an adaptation of this famous story from a comic book.
Gozer is not Thanos.
No, it is not. It's just the name of the entity from the first movie. Oh, it just made me so mad.
Yeah, that's your first legitimate complaint about Ghostbusters. No, that's too bad.
Yeah.
But I mean, yes, that is, this is the world we live in, Patrick.
I know.
This is the world.
I know, but it bums me out, you know?
It does.
Anything else that you want to say about Ghostbusters 2016?
No, I think, you know, I think you said it well at the beginning that the fact that these are women is incidental. It's not a movie about them being women. The Chris Hemsworth stuff definitely, you know, feels like an inversion, although at the same time, it just feels like Chris Hemsworth being, you know, the dumb guy. And that's funny. In the same way, you remind me a lot of John Hamm's character on 30 Rock.
Right.
Like it's kind of the same sort of thing. So, I mean, I think that, you know, it is a movie that is progressive in its ideas, but only because the people making it are progressive in their ideas and they're not, and they want to poke fun at some of these things. And these are, you know, they're just more inclusive. I don't think, you know, there's nothing, it would feel like it was more fan service if it was four men than four women. And again, it means nothing that they are women. They're scientists. Right. They're clearly qualified. And so I think that it's totally successful on that regard. I would say, you know, box office, schmucks office. I think that the people who are complaining about this movie will never be shut up.
No, for sure.
I mean, like if someone complains about something, you always want that smoking gun to just shut them up.
Right,
it never comes. There's always a reason.
That's true.
It would take something. So the people who hate the movie, who will never see the movie, will never review the movie, but will make YouTube videos about how they're not going to see the movie. They exist. They will continue to exist. They will always be among us.
Right.
I think the movie is good. I've seen in my lifetime, I've seen a lot of summer movies and other movies and comedies that have made me sad or disappointed or upset. This was not one of them. So I liked it. I think generally I liked it. I think your mileage varies completely. Some people are going to like it, some people won't, and no one's right or wrong on this except for those, you know, those people.
Yeah.
Those awful, awful people.
And I don't think it's a mistake at the end of the movie that when they do shoot the Rowan monster, they shoot him right in the balls.
Yeah. And I mean, that's just if you're gonna if you have a guy who's a ghost guy, that's where you go. I mean,
yeah.
That's just science. These are scientists. They're going to go with the science. You go where the science takes you. The science says balls. Always aim for the balls. This is not, you know, that's not feminist, Patrick. That's smart. Feminism is also smart, but that's not what, you know.
Well, I expect a lively discussion in the comments podcast, because I'm sure there will be people on both sides of the film, which, like you said, I think we are, but I think we're also pretty close to one another in terms of, like, we generally saw the same movie, except you enjoyed it more and thought it was funnier than I did.
This reminds me a little bit, although I think it's different. It reminds me a little bit of our podcast about Amazing Spider-Man, the original Amazing Spider-Man, where I liked it and you didn't. Although I stand by what I said there. It's fine. I've never gone back and rewatched it. I have no interest in defending that movie. I think that it was generally fine. I don't remember. I don't know what I said. You can listen to that podcast if you want to. I don't know.
It's pretty bad. No accident that it is Sony and also trying to create a shared universe.
Yes, like, yes. I mean, you know, the Sony must be stopped. At least in this case, you've got Paul Feig and a bunch of funny comedians.
Yes, so. And I'm happy to see them getting work. And, you know, if they have to make $100 million comedies, I'm glad that these are the people making them, even if I wish they had made a better one. Sure. But thank you guys very much for listening. As always, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter. We are at fthismovie. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Instagram or find us in the iTunes store. Leave us a review if you haven't already and you enjoyed the show. And as always, you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Next week, we will be talking about Star Trek Beyond, and we'll see if this summer can pick up, and we'll see if the Star Trek rebooted franchise can recover after Star Trek Into Darkness, a movie I liked a lot less than the 2016 Ghostbusters. Thanks for talking Ghostbusters with me, Eric.
You're very welcome, Patrick.
I will let you take us out if you wish.
All I can think of is I'm actually afraid of ghosts. I'm afraid of ghosts.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.